Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Okay, good morning. It's January 27, 2008. And from Rome, Italy, this is Solder Smoke 75. A lot of things on the agenda this week, kind of a mixed bag of items, but hopefully they'll all be of interest. I wanted to start out by recommending to you guys an article that I came across. I found this in my quest to understand mixers. I came across a lot of good articles, some of them available on the internet. And one that I thought was particularly interesting, I wanted to mention, it's called A Nonlinear History of Radio by T.H. Lee. And it's a chapter out of a book, and you know, when you hear the title of this, you'll realize that we have entered the geek zone here, guys. This is a confirmation of our geekiness. But when you're making a recommendation on a book that's entitled The Design of CMOS Radio Frequency Integrated Circuits, you know that you have left the mainstream of Western culture, or Eastern culture, I guess, or any culture. Anyway, T.H. Lee has written this book, and it's published by Cambridge University Press, 1998. The whole book, I don't think the whole book is available online, but the chapter that's of most interest to us, A Nonlinear History of Radio, is. And I've included the URL for it on the gadgeteer.news website. So if you're interested, please go to the gadgeteer.news website and you'll find the link. But I just wanted to share with you some parts of the article that I found particularly interesting. He gives a really good history. It's a mixture of the technical, the mathematical, and the personal, and it describes some of the struggles with theory and engineering that went on during the long history from, well, not too long, but the history from the days of James Clerk Maxwell through Hertz and Marconi up to the present day. He discusses a lot of the technologies that we've all heard about but never really thought about too much. For example, coherers, the detector that was used in the early days of radio, a glass-filled enclosure filled with loosely packed, perhaps slightly oxidized metallic particles, whose resistance turned out to have interesting hysteretic behavior. In the article, T.H. Lee talks about the coherer. We always have heard about the coherer that Marconi used as a detector in the days before Galena and other forms of kind of metallic rock detectors. But I found this very comforting. T.H. Lee, in his article, points out, quote, "Now, it must be emphasized that the detailed principles that underlay the operation of coherers have never been satisfactorily elucidated." Well, that made me feel better, because they were certainly never satisfactorily elucidated in my mind, and I'm glad to hear that I'm not the only one who doesn't understand how they work. It's also the kind of technology where you kind of think to yourself, you know, I'm not going to spend too much time scratching my head about this, because, well, we're not using too many coherers these days, and technology marched on, but and perhaps so will I. But T.H. Lee then goes on to describe how in the days when people were desperately searching for new and better detectors. They were using all kinds of different materials for coherers. And it says here, I'll just read you one paragraph. It shouldn't surprise you, though, that the coherer, even at its best, performed quite poorly. Frustration with the coherer's erratic nature impelled an aggressive search for better detectors. Without a suitable theoretical framework as a guide, however, this search sometimes took macabre turns. In one case, a human brain from a fresh cadaver was even used as a coherer, with the experimenter claiming remarkable sensitivity for his apparatus. Let us all be thankful that this particular type of coherer never quite caught on. Yeah, you see, this is the trouble you get into, guys, when you don't have, quote, a suitable theoretical framework as a guide. Well, all right, we aren't using any of those. I don't recommend any of the use of this kind of detector. T.H. Lee then goes on and gives a really nice description of, you know, the typical crystal radio and how it worked. And there's a footnote here. I checked T.H. Lee's bio, and he does not seem to be a ham. He has given lectures at ham radio clubs out on the West Coast, but I don't see any sign that he is himself a radio amateur. However, perhaps he should be, because there's statements in here that indicate that the T.H. Lee has the knack. I believe he may have been afflicted with the illness that has gotten hold of us. There's a footnote here in his article that for me, and I'm sure you'll all agree, this is a real sign of a symptom of the knack, a real indication that he has it. It says in footnote number 9, talking about crystal radios, he says, a 1N34A germanium diode works fine and is more readily available, but it lacks the charm of galena, Woods metal, and a cat whisker to fiddle with. I must warn you, Mr. Lee, you almost certainly have the knack, because I have fiddled with the cat whisker and the galena and iron pyrite, and believe me, I understand it does have a certain charm when you sit there and you tickle it, you find the sweet spot. You're getting back down to the real roots of radio here. Before we leave coherers, I said that I'm not going to scratch my head too much at this because none are still in use, but he has an interesting line here, and didn't realize this. It says, the coherer was well on its way to extinction by 1910, although as late as the 1950s, there was at least one radio-controlled toy that used a coherer. Wow. Okay. Well, moving on. He then starts discussing modulation and the first AM broadcasts. I always like this. The discussion of how Reginald Fessenden made the first Christmas Eve broadcast. I guess it was 1906. Somewhere along the line, I thought it was 1906. But I never really understood fully the technology that O.M. Fessenden was using in generating his ancient modulation. And here it is. It says here, on Christmas Eve 1906, delighted listeners were treated to a program of poetry, Fessenden's violin playing of Christmas carols, and some singing. Now here's the deal. Here's the technology. He used a water-cooled carbon microphone in series with the antenna. No messing around with any 602 double balanced modulators or anything like that for O.M. Fessenden. This guy made AM directly. He put a water-cooled carbon microphone in series with the antenna to modulate, get this, a 5 kilowatt signal at 50 kilohertz that was generated by a prototype Alexanderson alternator. This was all located in Brant Rock, Massachusetts. So, three cheers for Reginald Pheasant. And you definitely don't want to get your lip up on that carbon microphone there, old man. That 5 kilowatts at 50 kilohertz could probably give you a bit of an RF burn. But I thought that was interesting. I didn't think that he did the modulation quite so directly. The article continues here. I'm just flipping through it. It's all a great discussion of Armstrong and DeForest and Fleming and those titanic battles over patents and intellectual property and technology. Really great stuff. I really enjoyed the article. Got a lot out of it, and I think you guys will too. So by all means, check out and hey, it's free, which is great. And there's even some stuff in there about LEDs and Lossev's Christadyne receiver, which made me think a little bit about the work that's going on with tunnel diodes up there in Vermont these days. So check that out. A Nonlinear History of Radio by T.H. Lee. Very, very fine business. The other publication I wanted to let you guys know about this month is Sprat, the Journal of the GQRP Club. The winter edition, issue number 133, has arrived in Rome, and it is very fine business indeed. It's got a great cover photo this month of SM7UCZ's timber transmitter, a very simple one-tube transmitter, crystal-controlled. And he's got the key, the tube, the capacitor, the crystal, all on one little bit of board. And he's even used the board as the coil form. He wraps the ribbon cable very neatly around the board, and that becomes the coil for the transmitter. It looks really neat. It looks like a lot of fun. I think he gets out a quarter watt or a half watt or so. Even the telegraph key is homebrew. So great. Very fine business there to Johnny Appel up there in Sweden. There's an article, an introduction to basic DSP, I guess sort of at the opposite end of the technology spectrum. What else we have here? An article on the linearization of varactor-tuned VFOs, an issue that has troubled us all for many years. Actually, it is. It's kind of a problem that many of us who deal with real simple VFOs face, and K3NHI is a very interesting article on how to deal with it. Misusing inverters to drive a pair of headphones by Aaron van Waarde in the Netherlands. A Pi-T Mini HF ATU by G4YSS, John, in Scarborough in the UK. I will soon be facing antenna challenges, so articles like this are of great interest to me. And then the normal, very nice, that's a membership news column by Tony Fishpool, G4WIF. Small Talk 160-meter AM transmitter by Peter, G4UMB. Very, very nice 160-meter transmitter. Antenna Anecdotes and Awards, now conducted by G3VTT, Colin. He's got an article there on a loop antenna. Loop antennas are interesting, but I'm hoping to get something a bit more aerial-like up in the air here. So, but it's nevertheless a very interesting article. Communications and Contests, all in all a great issue, and of Sprat, and everybody who's into this stuff certainly should be on the subscription list. And there's ways you can subscribe all over the world. I think they have representatives. Well, certainly representative in the States and in other places that can help you sign up and receive Sprat. And really recommend it. Let's see what else. We're getting kind of into the odds and ends thing here. I put something up on the Gadgeteer News page that I think you guys will find interesting. It's called a cluster map. It's a little bit of code that you can put into a website And it's sort of like the counter. You know, you go to the website, it shows you that, 1,256,000,000 people have visited since last April or something like that. This one, it goes a bit further, and it displays a map of the world with little red dots showing where the visitors to a certain site are coming from. And I'm not sure whether it's capturing all of the visitors. I suspect it's not, but it nevertheless provides a nice display of where the Solder Smoke listeners are. And it's updated, I think, every day or every week. And I get a kick out of looking at it. And it's only been on there for now for a few weeks. But but Solder Smoke has red dots, and I'll just go through the list here. We have red dots, of course, all over the U.S. and Europe. A very large red dot in the London area, I was very pleased to see. There's also dots in Hawaii, Alaska, Mexico City, Buenos Aires, the Canary Islands of Spain, Israel, several dots in India, and I think I see one at Hyderabad. I think I see one there at Bangalore. So it's kind of fun to see them, because I think I know exactly who is listening in those locations, and it's kind of creates a personal connection with guys like Farhan and Ramakrishnan, who are listening from India. There's a red dot in Tehran. Great, very, very pleased to see that, and one in Pakistan. Looks in the northern area of Pakistan. I didn't realize that we had listeners there. Several dots in South Africa, several around the Cape Town area there. One in Brunei. Didn't think that we had anybody listening there, but glad to hear that we do. Glad to see that we do. Singapore also, I think at one point we had there was a dot there, and in Indonesia, South Korea, Japan, of course, many dots across Australia, and including one I think I see out there in Alice Springs. So glad that Alice is in the loop here. New Zealand, of course, and one dot north, significantly further north of New Zealand. I can't quite make it out on the map. It might be New Caledonia, but I suspect it's Fiji. So if you're listening from any of these locations, please let us know. I was a bit disappointed to see no red dots from China. We've been talking about this for a while, about whether we have actually any Chinese listeners here. And this particular display is not showing any. Although the stats that I get from my web host do indicate people are listening in China. I wanted to mention also that China seems to be coming on the ham radio internet a bit more than it has in the past. I've been looking at the Echolink screen, and there are now a number of Chinese stations from the mainland on Echolink. And as a matter of fact, last week I was calling CQ on VHF and UHF repeaters in China via Echolink. Didn't get anybody answered. The timing might have been wrong. I might have been calling CQ at 2 o'clock in the morning, but it worked. The connection worked fine, and I could tell I was modulating there on VHF and UHF in China. So that's an interesting sign. Let's see what else. I also have on the website links to a high altitude balloon project. This is something that, if you have the knack, for some reason, this is one of the things that you feel compelled to do. It's sort of like the knack. I don't know. It's sort of like the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where suddenly people all over the world have the urge to build this certain kind of sculpture. If you have the knack, there are certain things that you feel compelled to do. Crystal radios, superhet receivers, double sideband transmitters, these kind of things. But also launching balloons with cameras and ham radio equipment aboard up to the edge of space seems to be part of the syndrome. And there's a group out there that, well, there are many groups that do this. But this one particular group had a really good website, so I put a link to it on the Gadgeteer news page. Go check that out if you're interested. The pictures are really quite nice. A couple of notes that came across the ARRL newsletter that I get via email always has a lot of really good information. And this week they have a story about a satellite, a ham radio satellite that has been recovered. Apparently the memory aboard the spacecraft suffered some damage, and they thought they lost it. But then somebody remembered that there were some provisions in the code in the spacecraft's computer that allowed it to be reset from the ground and placed in a particular operating configuration. And I got a chuckle out of this because the satellite is AO16, and because of the way the software had been set up, it now is going to transmit. The downlink is going to be in double sideband. For fans of DSB, this is a bit ironic and quite pleasing, of course, because we're always told that we're using sort of old, ancient, throwback technology. And here we have an orbiting satellite. The uplink, I think the uplink's on 2 meters FM, and then it sends it back down on 70 centimeters in double sideband. So, well, fine business to the AMSAT guys for putting double sideband in space. Great. Hey, I mentioned Echolink. One thing I wanted to point out, it would be kind of fun if all of us on our Echolink displays put something like QRP or Homebrewer in the location description column there on Echolink. It would make it easier for us to link up with people with similar interests. I have solder smoke in my location description block on Echolink, and I'm very pleased that I've been getting a number of calls from solder smoke listeners who spot it and give me a call. I got a call yesterday from Waza VK2HDH, told me that he's a solder smoke listener, and we managed to have a chat there via Echolink. And so it would help if you put that kind of note there. It would allow us to identify those who melt solder on the Echolink system. Ooh, let's see. Ah, technology here. This is something else that we heard about, I think, originally from the AMSAT, no, from the ARRL newsletter, that there's been experiments conducted up in Alaska called HARP, where they're doing real high-powered, highly directional HF transmissions, I think in the area, not in the ham bands, but close by. And anyway, they were doing some, get this, high-frequency HF moon bounce experiments in the last few weeks. And I found this really intriguing. Apparently, they were sending so much RF in the direction of the moon that they thought that they could get detectable bounces even in the 6 megahertz area. You know, usually when you hear about moon bounce, it's sort of the summit of ham radio technical achievement, because it requires all kinds of really exotic transmitter UHF construction and big directional arrays at UHF. Certainly not something for the ham radio beginner. It's certainly something I've always considered way beyond my technical abilities, but now the HARP guys are apparently doing it at HF, and just, I was reading this thing thinking, wow, this would be something interesting for the solder smoke guys to hear about. And just as I was thinking it, the email beeped and I got a message from Mike, WA6ARA, who had recorded some of the echoes, apparently the outbound signals and the echoes coming back. So, and he sent it to us here in an MP3 file as kind of a extraterrestrial band sweep segment for this week's show. It's really interesting. Mike was using his K2 as a receiver. The antenna was a 40-meter dipole. The frequency was 6.7925 megahertz. You'll hear a very loud kind of outbound signal. That's the HARP transmitter on key down. Produces a very loud audio tone in Mike's K2. then you'll hear a much weaker signal. That's the reflection coming back from the moon. It's all really very interesting and impressive, and thanks to Mike for sending it to us. So here we go. Here's Mike, WA6ARA's recording of the HARP transmissions on 6.7 megahertz. Business, Mike. Thanks for sending us that very unconventional band sweep segment. What else is going on here? I guess that brings us to the time for the next segment of our show.
Sorry, smoke mailbag.
Yeah, a lot of good mail coming in. I've been continuing to monitor the activities of the tunnel diode maniacs up there in the northeast of the United States, led by Mike Alpha One, Tango Juliet. They've been doing some really interesting experiments up there, and I think they're approaching the 1 million mile per watt area. Mike, in a QRPL message, points out that he's got he just received the chip necessary to make a beacon, and he's planning a tunnel diode beacon operating at 120 microwatts, and he's going to include in the message some secret phrases, so that the only way you can really confirm reception is by telling Mike what the secret words were. So really interesting. The theory inside those tunnel diodes is really fascinating, and the fact that they're Mike, I think Mike said he's trying to shoot for a complete tunnel diode station. So fine business on the tunnel diode experiments, and good luck. We'll continue to monitor. I wish I could, maybe I'll try to tune in the beacon, but I think it's a bit of a long haul here to Italy, but we'll see. Kevin, M0KHZ, fine business call there, Kevin, wrote in, and he asked a question about how to properly balance the amount of time spent at the workbench with the amount of time operating the equipment. I told him that there's probably no solution for this, that he'll just have to retire so he'll have more time to devote to both. Kevin points out that he's operating in a shack that was in a building that was made in 1710. So that may be one of the oldest shacks that we have in the system. Fine business, Kevin. Thanks for writing in. Got a nice bit of mail from Steve, G0FUW. You know, and I just happened to be reading an old issue of Sprat from about 1998, 1999, and I saw Steve's name and call in there and realized that I was receiving email from him this week. Steve reports that the Bath Build-A-Thon went very well, and there will soon be a significant increase in the number of double sideband transmitters on the air from the United Kingdom. Fine business, Steve. And he also sent along some really eye-popping pictures of a work trip that he made to Zulu Delta 8 land. That's Ascension Island in the South Atlantic. This was prompted by my mention of the Vatican antenna farms here near Rome. He found, well, actually, he went to work on something similar on Ascension Island. Sent us along a picture, and it was so beautiful. I posted it on the Gadgeteer News website, so you guys could take a look there and see the very fine business location. Steve points out that he was listening to Solder Smoke there. I think he brought it with him in his MP3 player, but we're pleased to know that Solder Smoke was being listened to at that exotic location. So at least theoretically, we'll put a dot on the map there for Ascension. Lars, OZ1CX, writes in to report that he too has the knack, and that he too was born in the International Geophysical Year. So yeah, I think that was something that led to the knack disease for many of us. All that IGY stuff also was a peak solar cycle. So these things combine, and that probably explains it. Lars, he talks about a bit about how old Heath kits now are showing up at very high prices, and wonders if we should all now invest in kits. Well, we talked about this a while back. In terms of investment advice in the ham radio area, yeah, I guess Heath kits would be good. Also, solid state design for the radio amateur, of course. There's I've been accused of trying to corner the market in old SSDRA editions, but the price has certainly gone up. So I wouldn't put the 401k or the retirement funds completely in old editions of SSDRA or kits, but well, certainly a portion of the portfolio, right? Finally, we got some email, and this is related to a video. Wes sent this into us. W7ZOI pointed out that Jeff Dam, WA7MLH, has produced a video on YouTube about the production of a superhet receiver that he recently made. And Jeff should be somebody who's well known to everybody who listens to Solder Smoke. You've all almost certainly seen his work, but you probably don't recognize the name in the call. You should. If you look at Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur, in the first few pages there are notes from the authors, from Wes and from Doug DeMoor, thanking a number of people for their help in constructing the circuits described in SSDRA. And one of the guys who built many of these circuits was Jeff Dam, WA7MLH. I always really liked the circuits that were shown, especially MLH's circuits, because unlike the circuits that you often saw in the ARRL handbook or other publications like that, Jeff's looked like real ham radio circuits. They're usually very ugly. They don't have any of the kind of nice, neat, little right angle wiring that you see in the ARRL handbook. Some of the stuff in the handbook look like it came out of a NASA clean room or something, whereas MLH's circuits looked like they came off a real radio amateur workbench. Of course, they all worked perfectly, and of course, the theory was described really, really beautifully. But they were ugly like our circuits, and I always found them very encouraging. They looked like something that I could conceivably build, whereas the stuff in the handbooks, well, it didn't look like it was in the cards that I was going to produce something like that. So anyway, very much in keeping with this kind of ugly construction theme, Jeff Dam has on a YouTube video put together a superhet receiver using circuits and bits and bobs and stuff that he has on his I must say extremely messy workbench. So it was a real pleasure to see Jeff do that, and I put a link to his video at the Gadgeteer News page. All right, I promised this week to also include part three, the third and final part of our conversation with Andy in South Africa about boat anchors. So at this point, I'll switch it over to the Echolink files, and here's part three of our talk with Andy.
So that's 680Y, M0HBR, fine business, Andy. Yeah, well, yeah, about AM, I'll tell you about my AM station. Not here, but when we were living back in Virginia, I bought at Hamfest, I bought two different HeatKit DX60s. Neither of them was really in a position or in a condition to transmit, but I was able to combine them, take parts and bits out of one, and I managed to get one working DX60. And this is kind of it's AM, but it's control carrier AM. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It's not sort of the pure AM that you get out of a DX100. You definitely need to check out the DX100, Andy. I warn you, though, when you read about it, you're going to want one. And they're very heavy. They weigh about 98 pounds. I think it's got 2, 3, could it be 4 6146s in the final? But a lot of in the States they would call that a big signal rig or a tall masted AM rig. Anyway, I didn't have a DX60, but I had a DX40, and I used it with the VF1 VFO from HeatKit. On the receive side, I have it sitting here right with me now, a homebrew receiver, tube type. And you'll like this. It's from a circuit designed by a guy who used to write for QST, very famous in the States, Lou McCoy. He wrote many homebrew articles for a long time. Anyway, he designed this rig. It was just a simple single conversion superhead for 80 and 40 using 3 6U8 tubes. That's it. He had a crystal filter in it, but I built mine with without the crystal filter, just a 455 KC IF can for the filter. Anyway, that was my my rig, my lineup, and I was very proud of it because it was really, well, completely unique. Nobody else was running anything like this, and I would get on, especially on 40 meters, with a dipole antenna on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon in the States, and oh, we had a great time. We had really long rag chews. The AM, you know what I'm talking about. It's got that warm kind of feel to it. You'd hear the other guy throw the TR switch, and you'd hear the big ker-chunk, and then the carrier would come on and kind of drown out the background static, something that doesn't happen with SSB, of course. And then you'd sit back and let the other guy make a long transmission. In the States, they would call... and I guess we're engaged in this now, but they would call the kind of long AM transmission, they would call it an old buzzard transmission. Kind of an affectionate use of the term there. But and after a while, they would just say, go ahead and make one. And they would mean, make an old buzzard transmission. Anyway, you mentioned the transmit-receive with the Drake 2B and the HT37. I know the problem. And I have still the TR relay built up by my ham radio mentor, my Elmer back in the States, Hilmar Meyer, WB2NEC. When he first got me set up with the HT37 and the Drake 2B back in the late 70s, he was kind enough to build me a proper TR relay. Because I remember as a kid reading that all amateur radio station should be capable of going from transmit to receive by throwing one switch. And I've always tried to follow that one. So I had a really nice relay there, and that was great fun to throw that. You know, I've been moving away from the tube type gear, Andy, and I've gone more into simple homebrew solid state stuff here lately. I've kind of moved away from the high voltage, moved closer to transistors and 12 volts, and this kind of coincided with the arrival of my kids. I felt it was probably not a good idea for me to be working on high-voltage gear when I was sleep-deprived and with the kids around the shack. So I haven't been working on tube-type stuff very much at all. I'll, I'll fix the Drake 2B whenever something goes wrong in there. It's usually a tube going soft. But most of my work now is kind of in the phone QRP homebrew area. I've sent you my the link to my website. You can see what we've been involved in. I think you'll find it interesting. A lot of it's, you know, there's a lot of overlap between homebrewing and working on old gear. It's it's the fraternity of guys who still melt solder, and whether you're doing it to repair or restore an old piece of gear or build a new one, it's pretty much the same thing. I find I got just about as much satisfaction out of fixing up a really decrepit old piece of gear as I get from building a completely new rig. ZS680Y M0HBR.
Yeah, M0HBR, ZS680Y. Yeah, fine, Bill. I'm just writing down your website there. I'll certainly go and have a look at that and see what's happening there. And very interesting on the heat keep stuff that you have. Yeah, and I commented this. We're in that time of season now where the static can get extremely high, run anywhere up to 20 over the 9 on AM. And one of the most fantastic things to me is as you say, when you flick that switch and you just see the needle pop right the way up and the static just disappears. That to me is one of the most fantastic things about AM. And it certainly works fantastically, doesn't it? It's such a great mode. But of course, in order to do that, one does need a little bit of a tall ship, as you say, and one needs a good bit of output power. Now, we're quite limited here in South Africa with our output power. I often look at the some of the sites in the States where they're using 1 kilowatt of AM, and I think to myself, wow, that would be fantastic. We could go coast to coast with that one quite easily. But we're limited here to 400 watts, and even at 150 watts on AM, it certainly works extremely well. And my rig that I use, the 32V3, puts out about 60 watts of AM. But what I do is I run that into an SB200 linear amplifier, and I run the columns at about 30 watts and push that into the SB200, and I can run comfortably at 150 to 200 watts of 80 watt power into an inverted V antenna. I live on a small holding here in Benoni. I have 2.5 acres, so I've got enough room for for my antennas as well. And I have my normal long wire antennas. I have a multi band inverted V, which runs me on 80, 40, 30, 20, and then of course I have a 3 band Yagi up at about 15 meters. Additional to that, final power output here is quite limited, but it gets us around. I can tell you that it certainly works quite well, and in the winter time it's absolutely fantastic, because then we can run you can run on 30 watts on AM and still get good coverage right across the country. So it really does depend on conditions. And I was thinking to myself, you guys must be heading into a rather chilly period there in Italy now, as Europe is. My daughter has a friend in Czech Republic that they were both au pairs in the United States, and they were there for a year together. And this young girl has just got married recently, and she sent my daughter photographs of, in fact it was on the 13th of December, I think it was, and she sent her some photographs by email, and they got married in the snow in the Czech Republic. So I'm sure you guys must be quite chilly already and heading for some rather cool weather. Here, of course, it's our summertime. It's midsummer with us now. And the area where I am is not too hot. It's we've probably reached temperatures of around 30, 32 degrees, absolute maximum. But I used to work on the diamond mines out in the northwestern part of the country. And there we used to get to temperatures of 42 degrees Celsius. So it used to be fairly warm down there. And our average temperature at the moment has been around 24 to 26 degrees. So which is fairly comfortable, fairly comfortable. We've been through a bit of a cold patch recently, which is quite unusual for this time of the year, where our morning temperatures dropped to about 11 degrees. But daytime temperatures were fairly warm and been quite comfortable. Fine on the relay, and I must say, when I first got my HT37, I fortunately got a manual with it, and of course one of the things in the manual was this how to construct your own antenna relay. And working on the diamond mines, we had a lot of our equipment. We had these big control rooms which virtually controlled the entire process, and this was all run at 110 volts. So talking to my technician friends who worked on the mines, I managed to secure myself a 110 volt relay and made myself a an antenna relay, which worked extremely well with my helicopters, and I've still got that relay. I use that. The Collins fortunately has its own built-in relay on the back of it, which came with the rig when I got it, and that works extremely well. But yeah, I must say that it's quite humorous when some of the guys have to switch everything manually, you know, and if you don't remember to turn down something when you switch over, boy, you've got this tremendous feedback which comes all the way through and reverberates right through the AM signal. But all the joys of working with it, isn't it? M0HBR, ZS680Y.
Yeah, ZS680Y, M0HBR, stroke I0 in Rome. Very fine, Andy. Really interesting. Well, that relay on the back of the HT37, over the years, as I've gone through various different homebrew projects, at one point or another, when you're testing a rig, you know, you need something to be able to switch. So I found myself at different points, kind of, it was weird. It would be really weird because, you know, you could control that relay on the HT37. You could control it from that front panel switch to go from standby to transmit, and all you're doing is, you know, it's just putting voltage on the relay. And it's convenient because the relay is in the back where all the antenna connectors are. So at different points when I was building a new homebrew solid-state transmitter, I would run the, instead of running the relay into the HT37, I would run the antenna lead into the experimental transmitter on the table. I'd be using the Drake 2B, the trusty Drake 2B, as the inhaler, as they say, and then to switch the whole thing, I would be reaching forward and going, switching the standby to transmit switch on the HT37. So it would be really strange. It'd be this little QRP CW transmitter on a PC board sitting there on a table in front of the mighty HT37 and Drake 2B. And I'd be listening on the H2B, but the on the Drake 2B, but the HT37's only contribution would be to provide a convenient switch for voltage for the relay out in the back. I did that a few times, and it saved me from all these kind of, I know what you're talking about, crazy multiple switch throwing and lead throwing and turn off the receiver and turn on the transmitter, and yeah. I think the ARRL handbook was right in saying that you need to have just one switch thrown. You mentioned finding treasure troves of equipment, and it's an odd coincidence, Andy, because I had a dream about this just a night or two ago, and in the dream, I was in some crazy place. I don't know where we were, but we had come across kind of, they were kind of dumpsters full of stuff, and I opened up one of the dumpsters, and I found in it, near the top, the very first receiver that I ever, shortwave receiver that I ever owned, which was it was a Lafayette HA600. It was a solid state rig, but it was a general coverage shortwave receiver, and it was in excellent condition. I pulled it out. I said, wow. I said, this must be great. There must be all kinds of great stuff in there. And I looked in there, and it looked like it was a real treasure trove. But for some reason then, I was called away. I had to go take care of something else. And I said, let me come back and take a look at this. And of course, in the dream, when I came back to the spot, the dumpster was gone. And I started frantically running around trying to find it before they took it off to the dump or something. It was a real boat anchor's nightmare, Andy. I woke up in a cold sweat. My wife said to me, what's the matter? And I said, man, I had a terrible, terrible dream. Most people wouldn't find that in the nightmare category, but anyway, boat anchors aficionados would be equally, I think, horrified. Andy, I got to get going. The kids are up. The cereal is being poured. I know you're having yours there in front of the mic, but I hope we can pick this up again soon. This is kind of my time of the day to be on in the radio room in front of the computer, so perhaps we can continue on here if this is a good time for you. ZS680YM, 0HBR.
And 0HBR, ZS680Y. Yes, Bill, I've already put you down on my list of alarms and my list of favorites, and it'll always be great to chat with you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Andy. I look forward to talking to you again. I hope you become one of the regular guests here on Solder Smoke. It was really interesting to hear about the boat anchor operations down there in South Africa. All right, I think that about wraps it up for this week. Be sure to check out the Gadgeteer News page for the links and some references to things that we've discussed this week. One final note, and this is kind of a sad one, but last week we mentioned that we're just about at the anniversary of the death of our good friend Mike KL7R. I got an email this week that really kind of had me sitting back in the chair. Woody, KF4TQJ, wrote in to point out that on the memorial page that had been set up for Mike, somebody had written in and talked about their experiences of going to college with Mike. It was really a nice article. The guy talked about how Mike was really passionate about electronics and ham radio in a way that many of the other students in the BSEE program were not. And the author talked about how he and Mike went up onto the roof of the engineering building with a balloon and a large quantity of wire and put up a 160-meter vertical antenna. Mike never told me about that. And they had it up there, and they apparently worked the world with the thing, but then got fearful that an airplane might run into it, and so they pulled it back down. But really the most interesting thing about the message from Woody was the fact that on this memorial website, the guy who had been the student with Mike had pointed out that Mike had talents in many other areas. He was an accomplished sailor. He taught many people to sail. And he was a musician. I didn't know about the musician part. He was a very good guitar player and recorded a song. And the song was posted on this website. So I thought it'd be fitting this week to conclude Solder Smoke 75 with a song from Mike. And in it, you'll hear reference to a shack out in the woods. And I have to think that at least subconsciously Mike was thinking about a Radio Shack. So thanks, Woody, for pointing that out to us, and we'll conclude this issue of Solder Smoke with a song from our friend Mike. Fine business there, KL7R.
Worry, 'cause there's no one there to care about the man who is.